Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening and welcome to the LSE for this hybrid event, marking the book launch of New World, New Rules. I'll just show you the book. It's outside on sale, as I'm sure that you saw when you came in. So, what works for global governance? My name is Kirsten Steenbruch, and I'm a British Academy Global Professor at the International Inequalities Institute here at the LSE. And I'm very pleased to welcome both our online audience and also the people in the room to this event this evening. And I'm particularly delighted to be joined here by our guest speakers tonight, the authors of this book, George Papakontis. Constantinou, I practiced that and I'm still getting it wrong. I apologize. And Jean Pisani-Ferry and our discussant, André Velasco. I will properly introduce our panelists shortly, but before I do, I have some housekeeping issues as always. So please switch off your mobile phones. We are recording this event and hopefully this event will go live as a podcast very soon, subject to not having any technical difficulties. And as always, there'll be a chance for you to ask questions in the room and also our online audience through the Q&A function in the link at the bottom of your screen. Please do say or include your name and affiliation. And for those of you here in the theatre, I will let you know when we open the floor for questions. So just please raise your hand and there will be roving microphones. So just please wait before you start talking until you have a microphone and then ask your questions. For those of you who are following us on Twitter, X, other social media outlets, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE events. Now, about this event, we are launching the book New World, New Rules. And in this book, the authors examine governance practices across several key policy areas, in particular, climate, health, trade, competition, banking, finance, taxation, migration, and the digital economy, all very important topics, as you can see. They consider what works, what doesn't, and why, and they put forward some global governance solutions that require a degree of complexity, flexibility, and compromise. Attributes that I'm sure you will agree are very much necessary in today's world and also demonstrably in short supply. So to introduce the speakers, George is the acting director of the Florence School of Transnational Governments and at the European Institute Dean of Executive Education. And he holds the chair of international political economy at the same school. He is an economist who holds a PhD from the LSE, of course. Applause, and has served government at the highest level as a cabinet minister, member of parliament, member of the European Parliament, and has served as Greece's finance minister and subsequently minister of the environment and energy. Jean is a senior fellow at the Bruegel Institute, a European think tank, and a non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute in Washington. He is also a professor of economics with Sciences Po, and he sits on the supervisory board of the French Caisse des Vaux and serves as a non-executive chair of 14CE. I'm sure I'm supposed to say that in French. The French Institute for Climate Economics. I4C. And Andrés, whom I'm sure you all know, is Professor of Public Policy and Dean of the School of Public Policy at the LSE. Mr. Velasco was a presidential candidate in Chile in 2013. He survived. And he was also a Minister of Finance in Chile between 2006 and 2010. He was also a member of the G20 Eminent Persons Group. He co-chaired the Global Panel on the Future of Multilateral Lending Institutions. And he was a member of the Global Oceans Commission. So now I'm delighted to hand over to George and Jean, in whichever order they prefer, and they will be presenting their book.
Thanks very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. You will allow me the indulgence to remind myself that I first arrived at this place 44 years ago, and kind of it's painful to actually say the number. And I got my PhD from here 34 years ago, and it's also painful. And then I was back here 14 years ago as a government minister to discuss the crisis in a very difficult time. And then back 8 years ago to present a book, and now for the third time to present this book that we have co-authored together with Jean Pisani-Ferry. So let me start by thanking Andres for the kind invitation and the School of Public Policy. I met Andres for the first time in 2010. He had just stopped being finance minister in Chile, and he walked into my office in Athens and he said, "Let me tell you what happens next." Mm-hmm. And he was right. And it was a very rough ride. Thank you, Kirsten, for chairing this. And let me start by saying a few words about how this book came about before I go into the book itself. In 2018, Jean and myself found ourselves at the European University Institute in Florence, which, for those of you that don't know, is an intergovernmental organization, which is also a university, postgraduate only, doctoral degrees, and now in our own School of Transnational Governance, also master's degrees in public policy. And we started this project on transformation of global governance. And the idea was, as was said in the introduction by Kirsten, the idea was to look across a number of policy fields and figure out what were the new modes of governance that were evolving, what was kind of beginning to emerge, and what worked and what didn't. So this was a four-year project in the context of which we ran a number of seminars, one of which with the LSE, actually, on global financial markets, others with the OECD, with Hurti, with Bocconi, in our own institute. About 250 people participate in these seminars. We, of course, they bear absolutely no responsibility for what ended up in this book. Let's be clear about that. But we managed to sort of get a conversation going amongst this community of people trying to figure out how you can talk about global governance at a very difficult time. And how difficult the time was became obvious to us when in one of our first visits to Washington, D.C., we ended up talking to a head of a notable research center. I'm not going to say the name of the person. And we said, we're here to talk about global government. And he said, this is 2018, so Trump won. And he said, well, you know, come back in a few years, because that's not a topic that anyone in this town is going to be discussing now. So here we are, and this book comes out on the eve of Trump 2. And so what Jean will be discussing after me is he's going to try to answer the question, is this book still relevant in this new context? Or is this book having the shorter shelf life of any book on this topic? We actually think that it has become even more relevant, unfortunately, in the circumstances. So last point before I actually go into the book itself is to thank all the people who have read, made comments. They are also not responsible. And to also thank the people who gave us very kind endorsements, one of which was Andres, so kind that we're worried, given the stature of the people who gave endorsements in the back of the book, that those who actually read the book will feel that it doesn't rise to the level of the endorsements for it. But that's for the readers to judge. All right, so what was the starting point? What was our starting point? What did we set out to do in this book? Well, our starting point was a gap, or if you will, a contradiction. Or for the economists in the room, and the two of us are economists, a mismatch between demand and supply for global governance. And the mismatch is evident in the following way. From mitigating climate change to preserving biodiversity to figuring out how to govern the internet to ensuring that, you know, trade continues to flow to having financial safety nets that work globally to preparing ourselves for the next pandemic, it seems that we are more interconnected than ever. And therefore, some kind of collective action is necessary to be able to deal with problems which cross borders and which individual governments cannot simply address in and of themselves. So the demand for global governance in the sense of rules, tools, and policies seems to be larger than ever. And yet we are at a time in which the supply for global governance, the supply of global governance, is the weakest it's ever been in the last 40 years. In the sense that the old rule book no longer works, what we used to call the multilateral system of governance seems to be coming apart at the seams, and there is absolutely no appetite for a new system to replace it, not in the sense of us creating a new system. And so we our starting point was this mismatch and this contradiction. And we tried to trace this contradiction to the kind of big structural shifts that are happening around us. The first one being the fragmentation. We are interconnected like never before, but also the world is fragmenting in terms of trade, it's fragmenting in terms of finance, it's fragmenting in terms of data, and of course it's fragmenting geopolitically. At the same time, you have diverging preferences like never before. I think we can now put to bed the idea that the kind of values that underpinned the liberal international order are universal. They're not. And you have to live with the fact that they're not and trying to find solution environment where they're not. So this divergence of preferences is something we have to take very seriously. So one, fragmentation, two, divergent preferences, and three, geopolitics. We are in the midst of a number of wars, some regional, some but all of them have global consequences. So therefore, it is in this situation that we have to see whether we can reconcile this demand for tools, rules, policies, institutions that preserve global public goods or channels of interdependence in an environment where the politics and the economics and the structural change that is happening is going against that. So that was our starting point. And we did a little bit of going back and sort of looking at how the system that has developed after the World War II has evolved. And there are two main things that one can draw here. One is that, first of all, as I just mentioned, what was constructed was highly incomplete. It left out some of the issues that preoccupy us the most today. Climate was never in the minds of the people who built Bretton Woods and the macro-financial institutions of the World Bank and the IMF. It was just not in the radar. Neither was health. Certainly digital was not. So that system had huge gaps, and gaps which today are very important. And of the part of the system that was actually part created, today it's very contested. Trade rules are contested in both developing and developed world. The main guarantor of the multilateral system is now perhaps its main disruptor. It is in this environment that we need to find new rules and things that work, because we know that it is indispensable to do so. So the next question was, okay, so how does one try to figure this out? And again, we're economists, so our first instinct is to look for incentives for collective action. That's what economists do. How do you find incentives for people to cooperate? And once you start looking more specifically, you realize that even in areas where incentives should be strong, take health, for example, the incentives to prevent a pandemic are extremely strong. and yet we failed. So the rule book of economists of looking for incentives, where incentives work and where they do not work, is incomplete, and it is not in and of itself enough. Then we looked at other areas where other people in this room perhaps are much better equipped than us. The legal rules. The system of international collective action is based on legal rules, things that states are obliged to do. And we create international organizations that have specific mandates, and they're underpinned by law. And yet we realize that in the areas where these rules have been the strongest, the multilateral system has failed the most. And trade is an obvious example. Then there's the approach. So there's the economic approach. By itself, it's not enough. The legal approach, no. And the political science approach, which sort of focuses on power relations and institutions, and even that by itself. So our book is a plea for an interdisciplinary look on all these issues. So having established a lens, we then went into what we think is the novelty of the book, which is that we decided to look at 9 specific policy areas. Why 9? It's a nice number. It was 8, but then became 9. We grouped them into 3 different categories. Our first category is global commons, global public goods. And in that category, we singled out 3 huge issues. The first one is health. The second one is climate. And the third one is digital. So, health. We just came out of a pandemic. It was such a no-brainer to be able. There's a fantastic article by IMF economists that show that a $50 billion investment had the biggest economic and social returns ever, because it would have avoided the kind of cost that we went through by not vaccinating everyone, for example, or by being more proactive in cooperating in preventing the disease. So here is an example of a policy area where you have a weak international organization, but an established one with supposedly the mandate to be able to deal exactly with this kind of issues, and yet it failed, and we collectively failed. Take climate, our second area, an area in which it's hard to be optimistic, especially if you look at the COP results a couple of days ago and sort of numbers that are much below where they should be in terms of financing, but also the fact that the pledges are not up to what we really require to bring the temperature down. But at the same time, we note that this is an area in which economists would tell you that the governance mechanisms that we have put now that are guiding climate governance, the Paris Agreement, should simply not work at all, because they have no binding rules, no compulsion on states. They are purely voluntary. And yet somehow something is moving. And the question to ask is, why do we have some kind of movement, even if it's incomplete movement, even if it is we're not getting to where we should be? And the answers could be the way that the private sector has evolved and has basically pivoted to going for clean technologies, the way that China has changed over time, and importantly, the role of civil society and an epistemic community that is forcing public policy to catch up and push in a particular direction. So again, an area where your traditional reading should tell you that nothing is happening, and yet something is happening. And then digital governance, or the digital commons, the governance of the internet, a very different area in terms of its governance. Remember, most of the other areas, we set up big organizations at the UN level, with universal membership, with veto of a smaller state. In digital, you have what experts call the multi-stakeholder model, which developed organically, and then states started catching up. And here we now have huge issues, from security issues, where states are trying to come in, privacy issues, where differences are completely diverse between the US, China, and Europe, and issues of how do you rein in big tech. Huge issues of how you govern an extremely fast-moving area where, again, your traditional tools are not applicable. So that's our first three areas. Then we move to the areas that we call the traditional flows of interdependence. We call this, and we have a chapter called The Rules of the Road. What are these? These are basically the main factors of production. Goods and services, capital and labor. Translated into governance terms, into international terms, international trade, goods and services, international financial flows, and migration. So if you take the first two, international trade and international financial flows, these are at the core of the post-Second World War consensus. We created the World Bank, we created the IMF, we set down rules and very specific mandates for these organizations, especially on the trade side, with the court, an appellate court, which now is completely incapacitated. And it is a surprise to see that it is in these areas where actually governance is failing the most. It is failing the most because WTO is no longer operative. Now, you can have a conversation whether it is somehow operative or not, but it is certainly, we are in a transactional world where we're waiting to see whether tariffs are going to go up after a long period of tariffs coming down. You no longer have the IMF as the global financial safety net. You now have regional financial safety nets. You have self-insurance. You have countries in Asia having their own financial safety nets. And of course, the third of the three areas, which is migration, labor, is a complete failure in terms of governance. We failed with the Global Compact on Migration. And certainly in Europe, we have moved to a totally transactional, morally dubious series of agreements with individual countries in the periphery to try to stem migration flows. So here are the three areas that the first two of which, trade and financial flows, are at the core of global governance, where you have huge failures. Finally, our third group is what we call behind the border integration. What do we mean here? We mean that there are a number of areas where national policies have extraterritorial effects. Global competition is one. Global firms requires global competition policies. A second one is banking, international banking. Regulation goes beyond borders. And a third one that we're using in the book and we're looking at is international tax coordination, so governance of international taxation. And in these areas, we find that even though rules were not set from the beginning and they fail in the traditional reading, yet there are some successes. There are some successes in banking. There are some successes in global competition and even international taxation through the work that the OECD has done on personal taxation. So these are the nine policy areas. And at the end of which, we try to figure out what exactly are the elements that we could replicate and that could become a blueprint for some pragmatic yet principled policies that preserve global public goods and preserve interdependence. And I'm going to stop here and give the floor to Jean to answer the big question, which is this book still relevant today? Thanks very much.
Thank you, George. I'm going to be relatively short because I think it's important to discuss, but let me sort of, you know, try to answer the question of whether the book is still relevant or whether it's already obsolete. Probably on the day when it was published, it was obsolete already. And I think that that goes back to what George said about Trump won, and when we went to the think tank and were told, come back in a few years. And I think, it is tempting to say, come back in a few years again. Except that Trump 2 is not equivalent to Trump 1. We know from his appointment decisions that it's going to be, at least in his view, in his eyes, a transformative presidency. it's going to be his chosen nationalists to run different government agencies and government departments. He's willing, he's intends to be much more aggressive than he was in the first term, which started in a chaotic way and ended up in confusion. This time he wants to start in a very orderly and very systematic way, and he has an agenda. So the question is, what if is global governance going to overcome this situation? And I think in order to answer this question, because Trump will be gone in 4 years, but there is something deeper. And what is deeper is the fact that the U.S. Is tired of its global role. It doesn't want to, doesn't intend to remain at the center of the system, or at least it wants perhaps to remain at the center of the system, but it doesn't want to abide by the rules, the implicit rules of global leadership. And those rules, they were very clearly made explicit in a famous book by Charles Kindleberger, the economist, in a book called The War in Depression, about the 29 recession, the 1929 crisis, financial crisis, but what followed, which is the sort of the decomposition of the systemic the system of international relations. And Kindleberger's analysis was that at the time Britain was at the center of the system, at the center of the monetary and trade relation, but this had to be become this had become too heavy a burden for a too weak economy in relative terms, and the U.S. was not yet willing to substitute the U.K. as the country at the center of the system, and so. Kindleberger says, has this famous sentence that the Britain couldn't and the U.S. America wouldn't play this role. And what is this role? This role is a sort of the way we economists analyze it, is that it's a role that combines exorbitant privilege, the ability to, issue an international currency, the international currency, with all the privilege that goes with it. At the same time, there are exorbitant duties, and the exorbitant duties is the need to keep your markets open in distress, to provide liquidity in situation of banking stress. And that's exactly what the reason why the global depression arose, and that the role that the U.S. has taken on after the Second World War, when the U.S. assumed this central role in the system, and the evidence, I think, behind Trump, behind the sort of the reason why the U.S. elected Trump. Joe Biden said famously, Trump is a temporary aberration. And now Trump comes back, and we have to ask ourselves, it's not an aberration. It's just an expression of the fatigue that exists in the U.S. society vis-a-vis this role. The U.S. doesn't regard this contract as balanced anymore, and wants by now to extract rent from its central role, which is then unacceptable by other countries. So it's really a sort of deep crisis of the international system that is in play. At least that's something we may wish to discuss. And the question then becomes, what should other countries do? The temptation is to use the same lens of the declining country as opposed to the rising country, and to say the US is on the decline, China is on the rise, and there's a sort of mismatch between the speed of the decline and the speed of the rise, and that's a crisis we. I'm not sure that's adequate for the what we're discussing here, because essentially for reasons that have to do with both China itself and because of the nature of the problems we're dealing with. China itself is, spectacularly successful, but at the same time is in a serious crisis because it's sort of faces the economic problem it faces, but also because it doesn't have the institution, it doesn't have the outward-looking perspective that makes it possible to play the central role in the global economy. It's too different systemically from the rest of the world. And so for this reason, I don't think China can fulfill this role. And second, the sort of reason for which there is a possibility of rethinking global governance, and that goes back to what George was saying. George was saying, you know, the traditional channels, the ones around which the Bretton Woods system was built, the WTO was built, they are not the most important nowadays. Nowadays, what is much more important is the preservation of the global commons. So we're speaking of climate, we're speaking of biodiversity, we're speaking of, you could multiply the example, the congestion of the outer space, plastics in the oceans, etc., the preservation of the oceans. And that's something on which no country really is dominant. I mean, the U.S. represents 11% of global emissions. So even if the U.S. was willing to rejoin the Paris or to remain in the Paris Agreement, it wouldn't change problems fundamentally. What needs to be done is to build a global governance that's based, that's much more shared, because the problems we're dealing with are problems for which no single country dominates across the board. Biodiversity, Brazil is much more important. Climate, China is much more important. And so the question is how we, how the world can make turn this crisis into an opportunity, and try to rebuild governance on this basis. So, question is, what does it require, and what the role of Europe? And let me end on those two notes. What does it require? It requires to involve on a case-by-case basis countries that are the most important with respect to a certain problem. Again, those countries are not the same depending on the problem. The arrangements need to be much more specific, domain-specific. Now, we have analyzed, George has reminded, how the climate crisis is being addressed. I'm not saying it's being solved. It's not being solved, but it's being addressed. And if you look at the trends in climate emissions, and they continue to rise, they have to get to zero in terms of net emissions. But they are the second derivative is positive, and China especially is quickly reducing the rate of growth of its emissions. So I think that's an indication of what kind of approach can we put in place. And the rationale for doing it, the type of arrangement, has to be profoundly different from an arrangement in which one country is at the center. It's not, you know, again, finding one country that can be at the center. And so that's one important dimension. That doesn't mean that other areas, can be kept without changing the weights in the governance. If you take, for example, the IMF, at the IMF today, Italy has a larger share of votes than India. So the disproportion here is absolutely incredible. I mean, there is no reason. And what we say in the book is that Europe must accept to be diluted. And it must accept to be diluted, so to see its share reduced, and to give more weight in to countries of the global south in exchange for their taking of responsibilities in the management of the system. So that's a different type of questions. So what we're saying is that, and what I think is a lesson for the Trump era, that there are changes that need to be to take place, and that those changes are fundamental. What Europe should do, I said it has to accept to be diluted. It has also to accept to exercise more leadership than it has so far, especially on climate issues, on biodiversity issues. Let's assume the U.S. will be absent. And so the U.S. being absent, that means on climate, it's with China, it's with India that Europe can define the role of and the goals and invent this new government. On biodiversity, it's largely with Brazil, it's largely with Indonesia. I don't think China count much for biodiversity, but those are the type of approaches that needs to be put in place. Is Europe able to do it? That's going to be the big test, because there is no, Europe has a stake in global governance. Europe has... because of the way it is itself built, it has been very much centered on delivering on global governance. The question nowadays is, can it take the responsibility that goes with it? It has had the habit of hiding behind the U.S. The U.S. will not be there. And if Europe does not act, it's going to be much worse for global governance than if Europe does act. So that's where we are. On a mildly optimistic note, the mildly optimistic note being we can do without the U.S. The U.S. is not the indispensable nation anymore, as Madeleine Albright used to say. And second, we have alternatives on a case-by-case basis to the central role of the U.S. Thank you.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Good evening, everyone. Jeanne, welcome to the LSE. George, welcome back to the LSE. Kirsty, many thanks for chairing this evening's event. And of course, and above all, congratulations on a great book. And especially on a very useful book on a topic that could not be bigger, more urgent, or more important. George runs a public policy school. Jeanne works at Europe's premier public policy think tank. I also run a school of public policy. People like us often think, argue, what does good public policy writing look like? What does a useful public policy education look like? I want to begin tonight by simply saying this book is a very good example of what, in my view, good public policy writing is about. First of all, it is based on solid social science. It shows that these two guys are well-trained economists, one of them, of course, at the LSE. But it draws not just on one social science, not on economics. It draws on political science, it draws on law, on sociology, and on a bunch of other things. Secondly, it is based on evidence. There are plenty of facts in the book, and I learned quite a few facts when reading the book. But thirdly, and most importantly, it betrays a lot of institutional knowledge. You know, what you read in books and what you get from data sets is one thing. The way the world works out there is different. And to say something useful about the world, you need to know about the world. And clearly the authors do. Last but not least, you need a practical sense and a great deal of common sense. Evidence alone will not do the trick, and this book has a lot of common sense. So, great job, guys. Very useful, very important book. And of course, when you began writing this book, the subject was timely. With Trump back in the White House, it is even more timely. And I should say that the book paints a pretty gloomy picture. The world is fragmented. The world international sort of liberal order is falling apart. There's no global leadership. When crises come, like the pandemic, we do very badly. When you have an impending crisis like climate, we're not doing one-tenth as much as we should. The global financial safety net is in tatters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, the outlook is gloomy, and I agree with you guys. Having said that, I want to make 3 points. The first one is that, yes, the world is gloomy, but maybe not quite as gloomy as you make it seem. Not because the global arrangements are doing much better than you describe, but because not everything is global. This is the first point that I want to make. Not all issues that pertain to human welfare have international dimensions, and not all public goods are global public goods. And not everything that finance ministers do involves going to Washington or coming to London or going to Beijing. All my students here want to work for the World Bank, and I always tell them, sorry for the self-referential anecdote, that when I was a young man in the Chilean Treasury in the early 90s, I went to Washington once a month. When I was a minister in the Chilean Treasury 20 years later, I went to Washington once a year. And not because ministers don't, travel a lot, but simply because institutions like the World Bank or the IMF have become a lot less relevant to many countries, particularly middle-income countries. So, yes, getting the global governance going is very important, but not everything requires international coordination. The second reason why this is not as gloomy as maybe the book suggests is that certain kinds of globalization are not going away anytime soon. Or to put it differently, and to quote the headline from a good piece in the FT yesterday. Globalization is not going away. Globalization is simply changing face. And here, let me put on my hat as a politician. The most important and the most basic, if you want, face of globalization is trade in goods and services. And yes, Trump may slap some barriers. Yes, certain kinds of trade may go down. But the basic fact of life is that massive exchange of goods and services, particularly goods across borders, has brought so many benefits to people that no politician will want to get rid of it. And let me put it to you in very plain terms. I grew up in central Chile when I was a young man. You know, working class people in Chile had difficulty getting dressed. Today, most kids in Chile, poor or rich, wear the same trainers as any LSE student might. Why? Well, maybe because Chile is a little bit richer than it used to be, actually quite a bit richer. But more importantly, because you can buy those trainers at the local Walmart, for about $10. Why? Because they're made in China and they're very, 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 very affordable. When I was the finance minister of Chile, I was worried about the backlash to trade opening because, you know, we were doing trade agreements with everybody. So I commissioned the following poll. The poll had two questions, one after the other. Question number one, do you think that government should do everything in its power to defend local firms and local workers from foreign competition? 80% of people said yes. Next question was, do you think government should restrict international trade so that when you go to the local supermarket, many of goods that you buy from abroad will be more expensive? And people, 80% said no. Bottom line, because globalization brings us cheap blue jeans and cheap trainers, globalization is not going away anytime soon. And the third reason why I think maybe the picture that you guys paint is not quite as gloomy as the headline suggests is that, yeah, there are lots of failings of the international order, lots of failings of international financial institutions based in Washington and Geneva and elsewhere. Some are structural, some are difficult to deal with, and I'll talk about those in a minute. But some are easy to correct because they just come from either short-sightedness or plain stupidity. Let me give you two examples. There's absolutely no reason in the world why the European Union should insist on appointing the head of the IMF, and there's no reason in the world why the United States should insist on appointing the head of the World Bank. I was once, as a Chilean official, the host of the president of the World Bank. I won't tell you which one, but I'll tell you that he was a congressman from upstate New York. I remember that visit with shame. I have seldom seen anyone so ill-prepared for the job. If you think of the appointees chosen by the European Union to run the IMF, two of them in the last 20 years have gone to jail. One from Spain, one from France. If you drew up a list of the most qualified people to run the World Bank at the IMF and you look at the most recent appointments, would there be any one of the most recent appointments who'd make it to the top 25 people? Christine Lagarde probably would. I'm not sure any of the others would. That's probably, well, it's being recorded, so I've said it. I'm not going to take it back. There it is. Simply, it is not sound policy. It is not sound human resources policy to persevere with something like this. Another example of things that the IMF got wrong and which would be completely and totally fixable, and it is being fixed already, an obsession in years past with capital account liberalization. You can have lots of globalization. You can get 99% of the benefits of free trade in goods and services and free mobility of people without necessarily allowing short-term capital to move unhindered across borders. 20 years ago, the fund didn't see that. Today, I think the fund sees that. But, you know, it's a kind of thing that is fixable. It does not require a global tsunami. And maybe that one, the fund is beginning to fix. So my first point is, yes, the situation is dire, but in some aspects, it is either fixable or maybe not quite as dire as the authors suggest. However, let me move to point number two. There are some dimensions in which international cooperation is absolutely essential. And in those situations, in those fields of endeavor, the situation is in fact very dire and the outlook is indeed very gloomy. The most obvious ones of those are those that involve global commons. That is to say, the environment, and particular climate, and health, that is to say, pandemics. Here, local policy won't get you very far. You need global policy, and we are in a very bad shape when it comes to global policy. Let me get to the main contribution of this book, and I'm going to phrase the main contribution in a way that is slightly different from what George and Jean said to you, but I find it useful to think about it in these terms. The conventional way is the wrong way. That's one thing you guys are saying. Let me explain to you what I see as the conventional way and suggest what the non-conventional or unconventional way is that you're outlining and which I find very promising. The conventional way is this. You find a global problem, the management of the digital commons, the management of capital flows, the management of migration. You create an institution, a global institution. You have worldwide membership, so you have a big room with 170 delegations, and you come up with global standards of one kind or another. And you say to the 175 or 180 countries in the room, this is good policy. If you're a good country, you abide by these standards. If you're not a good country, you do something else. That system is bankrupt. And the book explains very well why that system is bankrupt. It is sometimes bankrupt because it simply was producing bad policy, as in the case of capital mobility. In other cases, it was producing good policy, but it has become increasingly hard to manage such a system politically, because the 180 countries in the room have divergent interests, don't like each other. We have two global hegemons fighting for supremacy, etc., etc., etc. So if we insist on that model and the idea of policy as best practice, or if you wish, one size fits all, we're not going to get it clear. That's kind of one big message of the book. So what does the book suggest as an alternative? And I think this is really promising. And of course, the book contains an outline, and I think part of the discussion ought to consist on how we flesh it out and how we put sort of more beef on these bones. The book says, look, first, we need priorities, and secondly, we need a flexible or variable architecture. Priorities. Yes, you have 9 areas of possible potential cooperation. Toward the end of a book, they confess that not all 9 are equally important, and therefore we need to set priorities. And they rightly say the 2 big global commons ought to be the priorities above all. So it's climate and health. These are the 2 areas where, as I said already, national policy is not much good. You need global policy. This might seem sort of obvious that you need priorities, but believe me, politics has a way of not delivering priorities, right? Whenever governments have to do their local State of the Union, presidents always say, I'm going to talk about 3 things, and presidents always talk about 23 things in the end, because everybody wants a minute in the president's speech, or in this case, every topic, every constituency, every lobbying group wants some space, 15 minutes of fame on the international arena. But we need to prioritize, and those priorities are the right ones. Now, if you're going to prioritize those 2, what is the model on which you could get some mileage, make some progress? And here the book draws on an analogy which I thought was fascinating. It says this ought to be a little bit like arms control back in the 60s and 70s between the US and the Soviet Union. Why is that analogy relevant? Because the threat was existential. If you got it wrong, poof, went the planet. If we get climate change wrong, or if we get a pandemic really wrong, poof, goes the planet. And as a result, when the threat is existential, the incentives for cooperation are larger. Now, the Soviets and the Americans didn't like each other, didn't cooperate on most dimensions. In fact, they fought wars, not face-to-face, but by proxy. But while fighting, by proxy in Angola, say, that were collaborating to make sure no rogue nuke was fired. The analogy is not perfect, because if you get climate change policy wrong, poof goes the planet, but in 100 years, not today. Whereas if you fire a missile, poof goes the planet today. So the incentives are a bit more immediate in one case or in the other. But I think this is a very good analogy, a very good way of thinking. China and the US may not like each other very much, may compete along a number of dimensions, but in these two things that are existential, they can collaborate, they should collaborate, or to put it less naively, it is not entirely insane to think that they could collaborate. And last but not least, this is not going to happen in a way that sets standards that are universal for all. Let me illustrate with climate. I think we have made a mistake, and I'm certainly not a climate expert, so if I say something wrong, please don't eat me alive. But I will say this with a bit of conviction. I think we've made a mistake by trying to impose more or less universal standards across the board. I'll give you one example. If you're a low-income, small developing country, your contribution to global emissions is basically negligible. Nonetheless, if you read World Bank documents applying to Bolivia or applying to Botswana, the World Bank says you have to decrease your emissions by 30% to be compliant with XYZ. I'm pretty sure that is not the most important contribution to decarbonization that Bolivia could make. In fact, it would make a lot more sense if Bolivia, in fact, burned a lot of fuel to get a lot of lithium off the ground. And by producing a lot of lithium and shipping it to places where the lithium can be usually produced, it aided the transition toward a green economy. And that is to say, the standards we wish to apply to Bolivia are not the standards we wish to apply to China nor to the United States. And this variable architecture with different countries of different sizes and different clubs that are held to different standards would seem to make a lot of sense. We don't have a lot of that today. We need a lot more of that in the future. I have one last point, but for that I'm going to get a little water, if I may. The last point that I want to make, and I will be brief, has to do with the role of the global south. There's an undercurrent in the book that says, look, back in the day, the Europeans and the Americans could sit at a table. Yes, the Japanese would be invited, but among us, we sort of reached an agreement. The world is a lot more complicated now because there are all these people out there who want a voice. They should be given a voice, but, you know, their mere presence kind of makes life more difficult. And among those agents whose presence makes life more difficult is the global south. I am sympathetic with this view, but I would characterize it somewhat differently. First of all, there is no global south. That is to say, it is neither global, nor is there in the south. Begin with geography. Last time I checked, Beijing was in the northern hemisphere. Moscow is obviously in the northern hemisphere, and Delhi is in the northern hemisphere. So the global south is actually in the north. More importantly, and more seriously, because that's a facetious point, there's no unanimity or even congruence of interest among the five countries in the BRICS. None whatsoever. Okay? And therefore, the pretense or the assumption, quite popular in the press nowadays, that there is such a thing as a global south leadership radicated in the BRICS, which is going to act in some sort of coordinated way, and that this coordinated way in some sense may end up being the other side of the table to the US and the G7, I think this is plain wrong. For some countries, you know, the global role is an aspiration. For Brazil, for instance, being in the BRICS is nothing but a vanity project for Mr. Lula. Brazil has no real chance of being a player at the scale at which Lula would like it to be. But more fundamentally, there are so many differences across interests between these countries that that is not going to happen anytime soon. Now, why are these countries, you know, banding in some fashion? And I will end here, simply because the West, and I hate that term too, but I will not get into it, has acted in a high-handed way by doing things like appointing the heads of the IMF and the World Bank and driven some of these countries away. And the West has also failed to do something which is very evident, provide cash when cash is needed. You speak of the global financial safety net. The reason why it is tattered is simply that the institution that ought to do the untattering is the fund. The fund has a capital that is way too small. The fund ought to be larger. This requires no cash infusion on the part of the rich countries of the world, but they have been myopic and they refuse to do that. So I think we could have a much more amicable or much less fragmented and certainly not a bipolar, I'm not thinking US-China here, I'm thinking rich countries against the global south, that division could easily go away if the G7 countries were somewhat less myopic. That may be wishful thinking, but wishing sometimes is all we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I'm now going to open the floor up to questions. Let me see. Okay. Why don't we start over there, gentlemen, and then I'll collate questions on you next.
Thank you very much indeed. Ewan Grant, UK Defence Forum, professional cynic on the operations of the European Union. So I'm particularly pleased that you barely mentioned that. You mentioned Europe in the wider context. My question is about health, but perhaps it could be applied to everything else. Did you see any signs that the antibiotic resistance issue was being taken seriously, perhaps as a trigger for greater global cooperation, both in health but across the board? You know, as a catalyst, that really is, they've been talking about this for decades now, and really not much seems to be done.
Thank you. And your question? Are there any other questions in the room?
Thank you. Thank you so much for this excellent presentation. I also happen to be a student enrolled under the program of Professor Andres Velasco in the Master of Public Administration. Professor Pisani-Ferry, one of my outtakes of your presentation is that a really important thing is to negotiate agendas holistically, to put them down not as individual single matters, but to analyze them and see where we can trade off to so that all of us can be better
negotiate
off.
Negotiate what?
To negotiate holistically. So how can this be achieved pragmatically? You're at the table and you want to make the agenda bigger. You don't want to focus on one thing, but expand on more. How is this achievable?
Thank you. Jonas from Queen Mary University. You mentioned that part of why the First World War II system failed was because it couldn't foresee some of the challenges that we face today. So how would the new rules kind of be more adaptive to not have the same problem 40, 50, 60 years down the line?
So if we answer those three questions and then we'll go to the questions online, who would like to start?
Can you start? I can start with a question that was addressed to me explicitly about the structure of negotiation. So basically what you're saying is that the fragmentation of governance, the sectoral character of this governance, is an obstacle to reaching agreements and to moving forward. The structure of global governance as it is that there are institutions that have limited mandates, and there is the G20, which provides the political leaderships and is able to mandate institutions and to tell them, this is what we expect from you. So in a way, I don't think this possibility of trading off one concession in one sector, again, another concession in another sector, is really impossible it's, I think, you know, the difficulty with what you're suggesting is that it supposes at some point that there is there's a polity, global polity, that can actually help achieve this sort of trade-off. And precisely all the difficulty with global governance is that this polity does not exist. So I think the world is trying to sort of cope with this problem. And what it has found in terms of, you know, sectoral specialized institutions with the guidance provided by the G20 is not that far from what is desirable.
All right. Does it work?
Yeah.
Okay. Can I quickly, before I address these questions, react to Andres, because I think he made a number of very important points. Point number one, you had exactly the same reaction reading the book as my wife, who started and said, well, that's a fun read. But actually, I think that our book is not as gloomy as you make it sound, because we're trying to say that there are solutions. It's just another condition. They're not the traditional ones. I think that that's an important point that you made as you went on. The Cold War analogy, I think, is a very good one, because yes, indeed, you can find ways. Let's take a specific example. Through the sanctions against Russia, we have weaponized the global financial system, which to the mind of many was kind of a public good. And we show that it is not, that we can use it for strategic needs. Now, we were perfectly reasonable in doing so, but there could be second-order effects. So how do we manage to isolate climate negotiations, for example, or health negotiations from the fact that China is looking to have its own system, that there will be an alternative to SWIFT, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's the big point. The question on health, the people that we talk to, because we're not experts on health, and in fact, we're not experts on any of these nine fields, right? And people who are experts, you know, we're happy to be corrected. Basically said, look, we've seen this before. This is a classic panic and neglect mode, right? We were panicking, and now we're back to neglect. It rose to the top of the policy agenda, and now it's nowhere to be found. And the kind of tools that we tried to put together, like a new pandemic treaty, etc., are missing in action. So it is unfortunate, and it goes back to political leadership and the role of institutions such as the G20, that it didn't stick. And that's a very worrying sign. If it didn't stick for something that was as major as COVID 4 years ago, which shut down the world, you know, it's not. That's not very hopeful, actually. On the question let me give you a quick example on the negotiating holistically. I mean, the G20 was extremely successful in the global financial crisis, and it was successful in an area that is not a major one, but it's actually very important, which is in managing to get some rules together for governance of international taxation. How did the G20 deal with the issue there? It mandated a nimble institution, the OECD, which had no, you know, from its mandate, you know, tax was not really at the core of the OECD. And within a few years, the OECD did manage to help with a bit of extraterritoriality from the US and the IRS sort of big hand to kill a lot of banking secrecy and a lot of personal taxation issues. It didn't crack the corporate taxation. You know, still have multinationals evading, but at least on the personal side, it did a lot of work. So that's an example of how you combine a political mandate with technical expertise and the ability to move in a fairly flexible way to get to agreements that in the end stick. Now, we are not, the question on how our rules will be adapted. We're not blaming, obviously, the post-World War II architects of not dealing with climate and health and digital, right? I mean, they couldn't have seen it. In the same sense, we cannot hope that we are predicting what will be in 30 or 40 years, but we're saying that we need adaptive mechanisms that try to bring these into the public debate and to preserve those when they are global public goods, those that are, because you're right, not everything is, to preserve those from the geopolitical rivalries. You know, if we do not manage to preserve climate negotiations from the big standoff, then that's a road that of no return.
I think Jean just wants to make a...
Yeah, I'd like to go back to a point made by Andres, which I think is really important about the sort of one-size-fits-all dimension of the climate agreement. I would dispute what you say, because precisely the climate agreement essentially requires every country to define its goals and proceeds by aggregating those goals and saying whether the world is en route to reaching 1.5 or 2 degrees or not. And it doesn't require every country to save on emissions. And you're absolutely right that the contribution from some countries, because of specialization, natural endowments, could be that you took the example of Bolivia actually mining, and mining requires fossil fuel, burning fossil fuels, and that can be the best contribution that Bolivia can have to the climate crisis. But I don't think your criticism of the method is justified. I mean, it's a fact, and I could imagine that in a climate negotiation, the objectives for Bolivia could be relaxed, so that they can contribute in the way that's the most useful for the world.
Can I say one thing about that? You're absolutely right when it comes to the Paris Agreement. But I'm not sure I would characterize other international obligations, is not quite the right word, the same way. Because if Bolivia goes to the World Bank and says, we want a loan, the World Bank will say, so tell me about your emissions. You know, you want a guarantee to trigger private investment in Bolivia? Well, it comes with a price tag. Similarly, with policies like the one the European Union is adopting, that will impose tariffs depending on differences in carbon intensity. Down the road, it could well be that many countries end up paying that tariff because they produce in a way that is very carbon intensive. There may be some dispensation for very poor countries in the beginning, whatever, but the principle in the end will apply to the world at large. So you're absolutely right. The Paris Agreement says, do what you can. But there are a bunch of other incentives that countries are facing that say exactly the opposite. In any case, I was agreeing with you guys. Because what you're saying is basically, we need more viability. And I am completely agreeing with that.
Thank you. We're going to take some questions from the online audience now. Just one.
The question is from Phyllis Papadavid, Senior Research Fellow at ODI and also LSE alumnus. What is the prospect, if any, for China to take over the US's role? Or will we be in a state of multipolarity for the foreseeable future?
So just before I pass that question on to the panelists for answering, if those in the room want to think of more questions while they answer that question, we'll take a couple more questions from the room if there are.
Thank you. I'm Gonzalo Arcia from the Embassy of Spain. Sometimes global governance entails creating or shaping markets. There's, example with carbon markets, also insurance markets. There are talks about this. How do you think that kind of governance through influence in the way markets work can contribute to solving some of the problems that you address? Thank you.
Anyone else in the room?
Yes, they do that. Hi, my name is Anna. I'm a political analyst in climate diplomacy, and I guess it's less of a question and more of a comment on what you just said concerning the Paris Agreement and what you mentioned in terms of like the conditions for the World Bank. And I think it's not necessarily just about a question of like, okay, countries should reduce their emission to get access to funding, but also making sure that there is broader governance and finance reform at the international scale to make sure that countries, including Colombia, for instance, that is taking extensive step to divest away from fossil fuels, do not get, do not get like downgraded in credit rating for it. And I think the current system as it stands just doesn't really reward countries that are taking the steps to reduce their emissions, which I think is a broader issue perhaps than the one you pointed.
Thanks. Thank you. George, John?
I'd like to address the question on multipolarity, the question that was raised online, because it's fundamental whether China is going to succeed the US or whether we are sort of for good in a multipolar world. I think I was clear enough. I don't imagine a situation in which India, for example, would accept the dominance of China. They have barely accepted the dominance of the U.S., but of China, it's India's rival, and actually the demographics of China compared to the demographics of India is such that, you know, the weight of India in the global economy may well be relatively soon on par with that of China. So I think it's truly multipolar world, and we have to build also a governance that's adapted to this variety of preferences. So the whole goal is very difficult to reach because it's so much easier to say everybody is going to converge on the Western model. Simply, it's not happening. Those countries are not converging. And so, inevitably, we're in a different world. And in this different world, we have to, you know, we have to govern the world according to what it is fundamentally.
Let me pick up actually on this question and then also address the other one. I have a colleague at the UI who speaks of a multi-order world, which is beyond multipolar. So it is not just the fact that it's much more fragmented and the different poles, but it's also different orders in the sense that you have different value systems, different systemic characteristics, and those, as John said, are not going to converge. Let's leave climate out because we've used that climate a lot as an example. Take privacy issues. How can you have universally agreed rules on privacy on the internet when you have such different ideas of what privacy is in different parts of the world, which reflect underlying values, systemic characteristics, etc.? Now, the question is, what do you do then? Do you strive to find these agreements and negotiate, or do you accept these kind of multipolarity and multi-order and work with that on basis of some minima, for example, on variable geometry basis, on safeguarding certain things, integrity of data when they're transmitted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's where we're headed, simply because, you know, there will not be convergence to values that we hold dear, but which are not shared by the rest of the world. And I think that that's...
Including between the US and Europe.
Including between the US and Europe, absolutely, yeah. The specific question, the specific privacy issue, of course, also divides the US and Europe. On the question of global governance creating markets, I think that's an important issue because on a number of areas, first of all, I think one of the themes that keeps coming back in the book is that global governance, as we understand it, is no longer governments making decisions. It is at the interface of public policy, private sector behavior, and civil society. I think that's clear. Okay. And you can see it in climate very, very clearly, but you can see it on all many, many other areas. So the question is, when can you leverage private sector incentives? And when do you need to go to war with the private sector? Because take banking. In the early days of regulation, you had capture of regulation by the private sector, and we saw the results. So, you know, there are moments where you need to simply go to war, but there are moments where you leverage a system that now works more as the various Basel agreements have kind of evolved, and work with on those. So absolutely, you create markets and you regulate, and that's part of what global governance is about.
Any question over there?
One, three. Okay.
And we have
last. Yes, I think
this we haven't answered the question on climate finance. Yes.
Do you want to do that now?
Well,
it was a my comment.
Last round of questions, and then we'll come back to that question. Yeah. Thank you.
So, my name is Nestor. I'm a business consultant, and I wanted to ask some sort of a devil advocate question here. We seem to be assuming throughout that we're entering a period where the U.S. power will wane and will be replaced by a multipolar, more fragmented kind of world, that what Jean just said, which will not have China as a successor. My question is, do you see a scenario where the U.S. power will not wane, will be restored to the full, but with a very different toolkit than the rule-based toolkit of Bretton Woods, which will, of course, assume certain changes in power and how power is exercised in the U.S. itself?
Hello, my name is Alistair Wilson. I guess I'm unaffiliated. It was just to pick up on Dr. Papakonstantinou's point, which I have a lot of sympathy with, this notion that we live in a pluralistic world, multipolar world. We don't live in a world in which the problems we face are susceptible to a consensus. There is no consensus around climate change, and we have to understand and we have to recognize and we have to work with that. Absolutely right. The problem is that in the current world, the solutions that that approach delivers are often very underwhelming. For example, COP29, the result of COP29. And I guess what I'm still struggling with, and maybe it's just that it's really hard, maybe it's because I haven't read the book, but what governance model, if we step back, what form of governance will help us deal with a world, a multipolar world, an absence of consensus, and problems which have an enormously long time horizon and therefore are well beyond the cares sometimes of those responsible for taking decisions?
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.